You're listening to The Chain, a science podcast where we bring what is new in biologics and protein engineering to the community of scientists working in the field. We discuss the latest developments with leaders who are on the front lines of cutting-edge research. As the Delta variant of SARS-CoV-2 spreads in the United States and there continues to be outbreaks, especially in unvaccinated areas, The Chain looks back to earlier this year when researchers virtually convened on the one-year anniversary of the first documented case of COVID-19 in the United States. I'm hoping that this provides some insight into what we've learned so far several months ago and how this knowledge that continues to change will help researchers and public policy officials move forward to fight the Delta variant and others. This episode of The Chain brings you a panel discussion from Pep Talk Protein Science and Production Week, moderated by Carla Satchel, Professor of Microbiology and Co-Director of the Center for Structural Genomics of Infectious Diseases at Northwestern University. The panel discussed the role of data integration for the rapid R&D of therapeutics and vaccines, the immediate challenges in the new year, as the Delta variant spreads this summer in the United States, and how we can transform nearsighted lessons learned into a farsighted vision of pandemic preparedness.
Hi, thanks for joining us today. I'm Carla Satchel from Northwestern University in Chicago, and we're here having a great panel following five excellent talks this morning in the Hindsight is 2020, talking about COVID-19 structure and advances in sequencing and technologies. We're actually on an auspicious day here on January 19th. It is the anniversary of the first detected case within the United States. And as a result of that, all the panelists on this group really modified their research and went all in, and really we saw beautiful successes. And so I just want to congratulate and thank the panel for all the work that's gone on in the last year. What I want to start is by thinking about this as the anniversary event of, with all that we came into last year, what we didn't know, you know, where are we now? We have had great success, but what should we be pivoting to really in the short term? What are our immediate challenges that we need to pivot to address sort of the next 4 to 6 month period and the next year? And Erica, I thought this might be a good question to send to you first. So go ahead and introduce yourself.
Sure. I'm Erica Ullman-Sapphire. I'm a professor at the La Jolla Institute for Immunology. And I think what we need to pivot to are broadly reactive therapeutics and durable therapeutics that are going to remain effective no matter what mutations emerge or how the virus changes. Because there's so much burden in humans, it's going to spill over again to other animal species or into immunocompromised people. We can expect to see more and more mutation and maybe seasonal return and seasonal drift.
And what challenges do you think that brings, Anupam, to sort of the screening profiles that you're looking at? And what do you see you guys needing to pivot to right away?
Yeah, so Anupam from Berkeley Lights. I think that there's a need for technologies that enable you to find therapeutics that are broadly active. I think certain technologies are really focused on solving the problem at hand today. But really what we've been focused on is developing solutions that allows you to, you know, that scale across different targets, across different variants of the same target. I think that's really crucial for response moving forward.
And I know the two of you, like, you're really thinking about antibodies. You know, on my side, I think we really think about therapeutics and trying to think about sort of how to make sure our therapeutics are broadly transmissible, that we're not going to all of a sudden after 4 years come up or multiple years come up with a great drug only to find it not particularly useful. And so that leads me to question, Arvind, when you're talking about all these ligand dockings, is there information that's coming from these variants or from different transspecies that you integrate into that work?
Yes, we do actually. A lot of the work that we end up doing is when we present results, we show on one particular target or so on. But that is actually culmination of work that's done on multiple targets for whichever things we have structure for. For example, we'll take the MERS example or the SARS-CoV-1 example and so on. And that information actually provides us with a sense of saying, between the drugs that we are screening, do we see some differences between one or two molecules? And if that can be useful for us to actually, like, go after new compounds and what sort of designs we need to do. And then there is the aspect of actually using AI and machine learning that helps us further understand those details, because the positional changes between these proteins are really small. So it's humanly impossible to go through that by hand and say, okay, am I making those changes that make relevant, you know, specificity? But it's something that, you know, it helps us understand better.
And Bill, you know, you just talked about this great capacity to do, you know, a lot of very dense protein purification, really pivot and optimize quickly. Are you hearing about new needs? Like, what I see is like we may need 100 different spike proteins very soon. Is this something that you guys are responding to or thinking about?
Yeah, in fact, yeah. So my name is Bill Gillette. I work for Leidos Biomedical Research and the NCI, National Cancer Institute in Frederick, Maryland. So yes, we are continually responding to it. As I mentioned in my talk, we do have a subset of the group that has maintained and been expanded a little bit in terms of personnel to provide ongoing support. And as was mentioned in some of the chat and the talks, variants of spike proteins, obviously big news these days, and I'm sure there will be other antigens of interest going forward. So there's a lot of money in those programs that we support. We don't expect those to go away anytime soon. So we're keeping an ear to the ground, making sure we sort of anticipate any sort of novel proteins. Right now, I think we have a good handle on all the proteins that we're going to be asked. But again, you know, what's the next protein is always the big question.
So the next question, actually, this was actually a question that was raised by Arvind ahead of time. And we're really thinking, we saw amazing amount of information. I think, Anupam, you must have, you know, terabytes of information about how different antibodies are reacting. And Erica, it looks like you have the same kind of information. How should we be integrating this? And are we integrating it well enough across fields? So if you know all about antibodies, but are we looking at that and integrating it with public health, with genomics? And how could we be using that information in a better way to actually accelerate efforts as we're moving forward?
So what we've been trying to do is make seamless databases that do integrate that thing. So Pamela Bjorkman started out by classifying antibodies into clusters, and we're taking sentinel members of her clusters and organizing them with our clusters on our panel of 240 so that there's a decoder ring to tell you what bin means what thing. And then our data is being integrated with that of Operation Warp Speed and the larger efforts of FDA and to build the databases. So in looking at the variants, for example, one group is looking at 200 antibodies in the top 12 variants. The other ones have flipped the grid, looking at the 12 therapeutic candidates on 200 antibodies. And the goal is to merge them together, and then we can see what kind of data variability you get across different assays and that broader set of information that links computationally to each other.
And Anupam, yeah, please respond.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think the importance of linking all the way from sequence to you know, in vivo function, global health impacts is crucial. You know, our part of it is small, admittedly. Like we have sequence and function information for thousands of antibodies, but it's really initiatives like Erica has presented that's required to link it all the way through. To the in vitro assays, in vivo assays, and so forth. I think it really puts a demand on our infrastructure to link all these pieces of data.
And Arvind, did you have a comment on this since you raised the question to start with?
Sure. I think this is where national labs actually play an important role in terms of integrating those information sets. In fact, one of the things that we had to do as part of this was to make sure the data was actually machine readable. Like a lot of people deposit databases, a lot of people create these databases, but they're not ultimately machine readable in the sense that machine learning algorithms can use them to make their inference and things like that. So I think in that process, if we think about how to do data integration at scale, that would be something very important for both the community as well as, you know, the broader impacts of how smaller studies actually can trickle down into these much larger scale decision making. The data. So,
and did you have a comment on this question, Bill?
Yeah. So, I guess the one thing that being a little bit in a different position from the rest of the panelists, I wanted to sort of comment on, you know, in terms of forward looking, what do we need to do? We just as a And when we're called upon, we don't get much of a heads up. And not that the other folks get much of a heads up either, but we have specific requests and then we have to do it. So as we've always sort of done, because that has been how we have worked for the last 20 years, the people come to us unannounced and knock on our door and ask us to make a protein, right? So we've been thinking about this, not in a pandemic sort of context, but our approaches then are similar. And what we want to do is just keep away from being very specific, trying to be as general as possible so that we're not shutting the door on any sort of family of proteins. We don't do membrane proteins, but we made that decision very early on. But, you know, when it comes time, if we were asked to make membrane proteins, we'd learn how to do it pretty quick.
And I just want to comment too, that sort of looking at how things can be integrated, right? We have all of these structures and we're working really hard to integrate that information with the genetic information and build websites that we can see these variants. But we're really interested in how this could be integrated really temporally over time and almost be predictive. So if we can begin to see where mutants are arising around the world from genome sequencing, can we predict, for example, what, you know, Will and Erica and Anupam, what you guys should be looking at as soon as possible in terms of getting new therapeutics and new antibiotics into the pipeline? So I think that's something that we think a lot about in the Center for Structural Genomics of Infectious Diseases. But with that, I'm going to go on into really our next question, which is, you know, a year ago, did anybody here work on coronaviruses a year ago? I didn't. I think, Erica, I saw you on January 16th last year, and we thought, oh yeah, there'll be something about that. But I didn't think we'd really work on it that hard. And I think 3 days later, we both changed our course. But what should we be thinking about in terms of the next pandemic? Should we just be preparing for the next round of COVID, COVID-25, COVID-26? Or is there something else out there? And what information do we need to address that? So who wants to take that on first? Erica, go ahead.
I can take it. I mean, the trouble with the mutations that you're always chasing the virus you just figured out about now that already flew on planes everywhere 2 months ago. And by the time you figure it out and you sequence it and you make all reagents, the virus has changed again. And so you'll never catch up. What we need to do is think about broader reactive things. So I actually have one of Anupam's instruments, the beacon from Berkeley Lights. And so what we can do is say, all right, look, we are never going to be able to catch up to any drifting virus that's respiratory and spreading around the world. Why don't we start very precisely and figure out what small molecules or what antibodies hit the parts of virus family A or virus family B, whether it's paramyxoviruses, whether it's coronaviruses, whether it's influenza virus, that are never changing. You know, the universal anti-SARBA coronavirus therapeutic. And the other thing that's always in common is, you know, we can't predict what virus family is going to break out next, but we know it's going to respond to a human immune system. So whatever we do to better understand how to inspire immune protection from a vaccine, from treatments, any of that is in common to anything that we might encounter.
Yeah. And, you know, and thinking about sort of where this conservation is there databases or information yet available, or do we still need basic information? For example, someone like Arvin could apply machine learning and say, where should we be? Can you respond, Arvin? Or do we just not have enough data yet?
No, I think the data is existent. The problem is actually finding it in the right position so you can sort of do these things at the level that you want to do. And I think there is a lot of efforts from NIH as well as other places that are like really pushing forward to do this. But the unfortunate problem is these are generated in very different formats. They are coming from so many different places. You spend a whole lot of time just doing what is called data wrangling, right? Which is that you have to get it all in the formats and everything in the right way so you can do the analysis. And that's actually impeding our current ability and the speed at which we need to be at to get to this point, and which I think will get better only over time. And with the new initiatives that NIH, DOE, and other places are putting together, I sure hope to see that this comes into a fruition.
And then just in our last thing, I actually just thought of one other question and thinking about where we were a year ago. For us in the structural biology side, the advances in synthetic DNA made responding to this fundamentally different than SARS. We had lots of structures in 2 to 3 months, whereas for SARS, it was a year before they had, you know, year and 2 years before they had as much of a structure we have now. We've just heard Anupam talk about their very rapid technologies. But where were our gaps? I think for us, protein production is still really slow, and optimizing protein production. And what other technology gaps slowed us down here that when we respond to the next pandemic 4 to 5 years away or even 10 years away, what technologies would have been there that would have made it even go faster?
I can start that off by addressing the protein point. I mean, you are all correct, of course, that making proteins is not the way to fight a viral pandemic. And fortunately, we don't do that. We're just making antigens for assays. But I think one silver lining out of this whole mess is the approach of the new approaches for those vaccines, the RNA-based vaccines. You know, that's actually opening the window for a possible sort of pan-COVID. Maybe we can cure the common cold as well as well as take out these, or at least a subset of the common cold. So I think that's, you know, had we those technologies, we now have them, right? We didn't really have them. They weren't proved before. And COVID sort of provided the first test case for an mRNA-based vaccine.
Anybody else on technical challenges that you faced in the last year that you'd love to see new technology address?
Yeah, I mean, I would add that, you know, access to technology was limiting even in this instance where, you know, our platform exists in many places in the world, but there is still a lack of access to single B cell technologies, which have been shown, at least in this response, to be the fastest way to get antibodies against a virus. And, you know, we had one customer, fortunately, GenScript, based in China, who was able to respond very rapidly, but there's very few that still have that access. And, you know, if you go about a hybridoma method and you end up with antibodies 3 months after you've started, as Erica mentioned, you know, you're now fighting a virus that doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. So it's really critical that there are technologies that are accessible.
Yeah. So in our last 3 minutes, do we have any comments from the panelists about sort of your hindsight is 2020. What have we learned and where should we go?
I think, so since everyone's still thinking, you know, one of the questions I posed in the presentation was, how do we learn from this to other therapeutic targets, to other diseases? And in a public health sense, this has been an extreme tragedy. In a therapeutic development sense, it's been a remarkable success. So why can't we do the same for other diseases? Like, what are the technology gaps that have existed that we've been able to overcome so rapidly this year? I think there's an opportunity for us to reflect on that and say, maybe this response is also something that we can leverage for other diseases.
Any final comments, Erica?
More viruses will always come. It is a truth. And the best we can do to come up with systems, databases, expectations, plans, platforms to respond, the better.
And Arvind, any last comments?
No, I agree with Erica. I think the ability to stand up computing at scale, especially in the context of these emerging diseases, is going to be critical. I think we also need to focus a lot more in the collection of data. I mean, we knew about these existence of reservoirs in bats, and we know what kind of viruses exist. But I think there should be a full, comprehensive nature of actually mapping out what's going on. And getting that to a place where we can understand how this might impact our day-to-day being, I think, is going to be critical for the future.
Final comments, Bill?
Yeah, I just would, obviously all of us are in agreement that we're going to have to face this problem in the future. And I would say that our approach is going to be more of the same of enhancing our primary, our first principles type of research and expanding the options we have in terms of expression platforms. We were lucky this year to discover a new expression platform. We had it running, and it actually saved us in producing some of our proteins for none that I talked about today, but my colleague Simon Messing has a talk later on this week in which he talks about a new expression platform. So I think more of the same.
And I just want to make one final comment. You know, I think, a lot of the panelists here, one of the things that we really had pre-existing infrastructure. Erica had this entire infrastructure for dealing with Ebola that was able to respond, the national labs, and as well as companies, and we're able to pivot very fast. And that importance of having scientists that are dealing with everyday basic science and translational problems to pivot is what's very important. So thank you all for your contributions.
Thank you, Carla.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye to the audience.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us on The Chain. Tune in next episode for more conversations about science, research, and exploring the world of protein engineering.